Here on FM, our Book of the Week continues Andrew Wilson's new biography of the early life of American poet and novelist Sylvia Plath. Having lost her father when she was just 8 years old, the teenage Sylvia Plath begins to find her feet as a writer. Hayley Atwell reads Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath's words are read by Sasha Pick.
At the beginning of September 1947, Sylvia enrolled at Gamaliel Bradford High School. From the moment she met her new English teacher, Wilbury Crockett, she declared him to be an inspiration. In one of Sylvia's first classes, he played to his new students recordings of Edna St. Vincent Millay's The Ballad of the Harp Weaver and Renaissance, read by the poet. That day, Sylvia returned home and wrote what she considered two of her best poems to date, Alone and Alone in the Woods Was I and City Streets. Whereas almost half the original pupils dropped out of Mr. Crockett's class within a matter of days because they considered it too demanding, Sylvia flourished. Each year, Crockett gave his pupils, still in high school, a reading list of between 40 and 45 books. Everything from Greek drama and philosophy through Shakespeare and classic American authors such as Hawthorne, Thoreau, and Melville. Each work had to be not only read, but also analysed, discussed, debated, and absorbed. Sylvia sped ahead, energised and transported as she was by the intellectual rigour of the class. On the 10th of September, she gave a few of her poems to Crockett, who proceeded to read four of them to the class. According to her diary entry, the teacher said, Alone and Alone in the Woods Was I, and I Thought That I Could Be Hurt, were her best, and proclaimed that she had a lyric gift beyond the ordinary. The next day, Sylvia confessed in her diary that she had been so animated by Crockett and his nonconformist methods of teaching that she was being forced to question certain truths regarding religion and human nature that she had always taken for granted. The disparity between the patina of superficial appearances and the realities of one's inner world was something Sylvia began to notice more and more. In the autumn of 1949, she attended a party in Belmont with a boy named Rod. As she stepped into the room, she noticed that a lot of the group were quite drunk, and although she was in high spirits herself, she soon began to notice that the event was not quite as jolly as it first seemed. She compared it to a Christmas decoration, bright and polished on the surface, but completely empty inside. She observed that quite a number of the young men and women there who had been going steady had changed their partners. She likened this fickleness to the act of shuffling through a deck of cards to form an infinite number of different possibilities. She realised that she was merely playing a part too. Rod didn't mean anything to her. And she was anxious that she might accept an artificial way of communicating as the norm.
I want to scream sometimes. If I close my eyes and let myself go, I can hear the voices grow strident, loosely woven without meaning, like the senseless clacking of birds. It's a crazy pattern of sounds. I feel trapped, frozen. Can I never express myself? Must I always be wandering in a vague mist of unborn dreams and half-formed ideas? I long to know myself. I long to be articulate.
At the end of September 1949, Aurelia Plath wrote a letter to Smith College, the elite women-only university in Northampton, Massachusetts, asking for information about the application procedure for her daughter. Sylvia was confident of her academic record. She achieved a string of A's, yet she didn't want to appear, in the words of her guidance counsellor, too dangerously brainy. This obsession with getting into college, Sylvia later defined as a subtle, terrifying virus that infected many of her friends.
After all, we could be anybody. If we worked, if we studied hard enough, our accents, our money, our parents didn't matter. Education was the answer.
This was all very well, but Aurelia worried about how she would finance her daughter's college education. A four-year course at Smith was an expensive proposition. To the student whose income is decidedly limited, a college education may be possible with the aid of scholarships and self-help work, read one leaflet from Smith that was sent to Sylvia at this time. Only a student who is physically strong and whose academic standing is satisfactory should ever try to take on extra work for the sake of decreasing expenses. Sylvia, it seems, took no notice of the advice. Throughout her time at college, she felt she needed to try to sell her stories and poems so as to contribute towards her rising expenses. During 1950, Sylvia composed a number of fine poems. In one, Midnight Snow, Plath writes of the wish to simply fade away and disappear into the white, snow-covered landscape, dissolving
the atoms of myself into the atmosphere.
Perhaps it was this interior hollowness that prompted her need to compete in such a spectacular fashion. She was addicted to achievement. The winning of awards, certificates, and prizes were all signifiers of attainment that helped boost her self-esteem. On the 10th of May, she heard from Ruth Crawford to say that she had been accepted at Smith with a good scholarship. In August, the young women's magazine, 17, published her story, And Summer Will Not Come Again, for which they paid $15. Shortly afterwards, she received a curious fan letter from a 21-year-old English major from Chicago called Eddie Cohen.
Normally, I do not collect autographs, write letters to the editor, nor play hunches. The stories in 17 are generally so much drivel. On one occasion, though, I ran across a story which moved me enough so that I had to repress myself from crying out Eureka or something equally unlikely. In part, it was because I felt there was a thought behind the story which was expressed rather more subtly than the usual 17 hit 'em with a brick technique, and also because it seemed that the author had an insight into people which was a little above average.
Sylvia wrote back a cool, ironic letter in which she managed to describe the basic details of her life without appearing too sincere or earnest. If he was prepared to let down his guard, what she called his little wall of polished humour, then she would be overjoyed if he could take on the role as an informal critic of her writing. Over the course of the next 4 years, Eddie Cohen assumed the role not only of informal literary critic, but also of fantasy boyfriend, agony aunt, sex counsellor, and psychotherapist. Sylvia's letters to him, letters that are, by turns, open, funny, heartfelt, angry, perplexed, and at times despondent, served as a kind of alternative journal. From the beginning, there was an intimacy between them, an intimacy that was forged by, and to a certain extent depended on, their status as strangers.
I feel like a guy who has just weathered his first date with a new girl. Now I can loosen my tie, open my collar, and begin to enjoy myself. And I do think that I will enjoy myself, because if your first letter is any indication, my hunch has paid off with a pretty sharp kid. You may blush now. Nobody is looking.
By the time Sylvia arrived at Smith in September 1950, the academic reputation of the college was outstanding. The general stereotype of a Smithie was a girl who was eminently sensible, highly intelligent, charming, and often quite wealthy. A perfect wife for her male counterpart at Yale or Princeton. Although Sylvia was a scholarship student, the continuance of her grant depended on her earning top grades. If her marks slipped, her money would be withdrawn and she would have no choice but to leave. Sylvia started to keep a record of exactly how much she spent. She deposited $180 in the bank and noted, quite guiltily, in a letter home to her mother that she spent $4 on a table. At times, Sylvia felt empty, blank, in need of an identity.
There is so much here, and it is up to me to find myself and make the person I will be.
At the end of October, Sylvia was called in to see Mary Elizabeth Mensel, the director of scholarships and student aid at Smith. During the conversation, Menzel revealed to Sylvia the identity of her benefactress, the woman who had endowed her $850 scholarship and who had, in effect, changed the course of her life, the novelist Olive Higgins Prouty. Prouty, who had graduated from Smith in 1904, had made a fortune by writing lush, best-selling melodramas such as Now Voyager.
Miss Menzel said that it was seldom given to freshmen, but with my enjoyment of writing, Olive Higgins Prouty would be very pleased to hear from me and learn about my achievements and future plans, and also about the impact Smith has had on me.
In many ways, Sylvia could have stepped straight out of one of Prouty's books, particularly Now Voyager. The novel tells the story of Charlotte Vale, a repressed, fatherless, rather bookish woman who attempts to free herself from the unhealthy grip of an overpossessive mother. Like Charlotte, Sylvia questioned the reality of her own existence and often felt separated and distanced from the immediacy of her life. The two women, the fictional and the real, experienced, as Prouty writes in the novel, a sensation of detachment from their own personalities, a symptom that, in both cases, would culminate in a nervous breakdown. One day, while sitting in the library at Smith, Sylvia took out her journal and wrote about how she felt lost, leached of identity.
God, who am I?
She asked, as she looked around and saw the room packed with girls. She likened the college to a centre for conditioning.
If I rest, if I think inward, I go mad.
Sylvia's spirits were boosted when she received a letter from Olive Higgins Prouty inviting her to tea at her home over the Christmas vacation. Over tea and cucumber sandwiches, Prouty asked Sylvia about her background. She told her that after her daddy had died, her mother had taken a teaching job. Had she ever written about her family? Sylvia told her she had not. Well, after all, she came from such an ordinary home. For you, perhaps, Mrs. Prouty smiled, but not for me, not for others. Think of the material you have there. As she left the Brookline mansion, Sylvia felt confident to be able to follow Prouty's guidelines. After all, observed Plath, a trip to the local store could be just as interesting as a description of a journey to Tibet. The skill lay in the storytelling, the development of narrative and drama. Whenever she felt discouraged or bored with her writing, she said she would remember Prouty's words, "Take life."
And tomorrow, Sylvia struggles with the sexual conventions of 1950s America. Hayley Atwell was reading from Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath was played by Sasha Pick and Eddie Cohen by Ben Crowe. The book was abridged by Miranda Davis and produced by Emma Harding. And Sylvia Plath's novel, The Bell Jar, is this week's book at bedtime. And in today's extract, things don't go so well after the Ladies' Day lunch, and Esther remembers the first time Buddy Willard kissed her at the Yale Junior Prom. The Bell Jar continues tonight at 10:45. In a couple of minutes, Eve Pollard, chair of the judging panel, reveals the Woman's Hour Power List in a special programme with an audience at the BBC Radio Theatre, presented by Jenny Murray and Jane Garvey. What does the list tell us, and what might a future list look like? Questions for Woman's Hour after the news.
If you hear hand rattles, do not leave your shelter until the poison gas has been cleared away.
As war breaks out, are the children of the Cazalet family feeling sheltered or shut out?
What are they saying? They're talking about us. What they'll do with us?
The Cazalets, Marking Time on BBC Radio 4.
I think everything changes. Of course, I may feel differently in the years to come, but there's plenty of time.
Begins next Monday at 10:45 in the morning and 7:45 in the evening.